Greetings. Welcome to each one here this morning. And I trust that God's presence can continue to be sensed and we can be led by Him this morning in the message. This morning, for a message, I've been led to a character study. And I'd like to begin with a little quiz and I would like to see if one of the young men on the first two or three benches could answer this quiz. Who was one of the bravest men of the Bible? A loyal son, a great friend, and an excellent archer. Don't be afraid to say. Surely you have a thought in your mind. Somebody said Jonathan, right? Jonathan is the one that I was thinking of. So I couldn't help but think of this morning when Michael was up here. Morning, we're going to see how Jonathan lived in the presence of God, like was depicted in that circle, as opposed to some of the things that are written around the outside of it. This story is one of the greatest sagas in the world. A saga is a long, complicated, complex story. To me, it's one of the greatest in the world, in my opinion, along with the stories of Joseph, David, and Esther, and maybe a few others. We're perhaps a bit more familiar with the stories of those for whom things ended well, in a physical sense, for those who came out on top. But here is one whom I believe was no less of a man. Not one bit less brave, not at all less committed, but one for whom God had another purpose to fulfill, a very special purpose, as we shall see, though he did not experience an end like anyone would truly desire. His name means gift from God, or gift from Jehovah, and the story of his life has certainly been a gift to all humanity. Jonathan shows us how to live and how to die for a worthy conviction. When in great conflict between good and evil, and even when our hopes and dreams have been shattered, his story is too big and deep for us to explore every angle in detail today. And you will likely notice more lessons that I do not have time to mention. Maybe you'll be inspired to study it further. And I thought I was ready this morning, but I just almost got lost in the information and hardly knew how to pull it together. But I'll do the best I can. The title of the message is The High Places of Jonathan. And if that doesn't ring a bell for you, that term high places is taken from David's eulogy of him in 2 Samuel 1 verse 25, and we'll read that near the end of the message, but for now you may turn to 1 Samuel 13. Romans 15:4 says that for whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. And so it's my prayer this morning that we may all be blessed with hope for navigating the difficulties in our own lives as we consider the life of Jonathan. 1 Samuel 13 is the first place he is mentioned in the scriptures. In the preceding chapters, we have the account of his his father Saul's ascension to the throne as the first king of Israel. We know how Saul was this tall but bashful young man, very humble. And he was out searching for his father's donkeys and met Samuel, who anointed him king over Israel. Started out as a humble servant of the people, but it seems like after a notable victory and the popularity that followed, he began to rely on his own skill and strength rather than on the Lord. But meanwhile, Saul had a son that had come of age that was apparently inspired by the earlier and nobler traits of his father. And I want to just break in here at verse 2 of 1 Samuel chapter 13 and read a few verses here. Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was had an abomination with the Philistines, and the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the sea in multitude, and they came up and pitched in Michmash, eastward from Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves, and in thickets, and in rocks, and in high places, and in pits. You see, these men were like Jonah, weren't they? And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Leave off reading here for now. But there's a number of things that I want to mention here in the beginning about Jonathan. And some of these things you may not pull out of this first account alone. But as you look at his story from front to back, and at what apparently drove his life, and what he obviously lived for, one may make some assessments from the very beginning, and I want to share them here in the beginning so that you can be noticing them throughout the story of his life. But here in this account, it does not seem at all that Saul was taking an aggressive enough stance against the enemies of the Lord. He whittled down the army to 3,000 men and just took sort of an accepting and defensive position against the Philistines rather than going out and dealing with them, delivering the Lord's people as he was called to do. And here we also get our first glimpse of Saul's confidence and trust in Jonathan and of the mutual relationship that they shared. Saul kept 2,000 of the men with him and put young Jonathan in charge of the other 1,000. And Israel was in very poor shape as a nation at this time, as we shall notice later on in this chapter and in this account. And so here is Jonathan in a set of very unfortunate circumstances, something that he had not asked for, something that he was not responsible for causing. And while Saul moped around and refused to get serious about facing the enemy, Jonathan saw a much bigger picture. He obviously knew the Lord, the God of the armies of Israel. And there was a cause that was much bigger than himself. He was not given 1,000 men at his command to merely sit under a tree and watch the world go by and hope for better luck or a change in circumstances. Here was a Philistine outpost in the land of Israel, a continual reminder of the power of the Philistines that they still wielded over Israel hundreds of years after they should have been thoroughly conquered. And so in this story, we see the difference in the influence that a single individual can have on a whole nation and on multiple generations. And so take this as the first major lesson from Jonathan's life. One of his high places, if you will. Jonathan made a daring move. With a very small army, and without communication with his father, he attacked the garrison of the Philistines. And we don't know for sure what all was on his mind. I'm sure that he could have well known that he was stirring a hornet's nest and making a serious affront to the Philistines. Perhaps he was just fed up with God's people being subject to the Philistines, but likely there were nobler thoughts going through his mind. He would well have known Israel's history, their triumphs over the Canaanites in the time of Moses, Joshua, and the faithful judges. He knew that God's plan for Israel was much more glorious than what was taking place right now. Instead of viewing it as an insurmountable set of circumstances, he recognized it as an opportunity. Yes, his father was weak and failing, and the kingdom was faltering, but he chose to think on the things that were right and on what he did have instead of what was wrong and the overwhelming odds. Number two, he apparently believed that God placed him here at this time and place for a reason. He was a prince with 1,000 soldiers at his command, and he believed in God. He saw this as his opportunity, and not only as his opportunity, but as his responsibility as well. And so perhaps this was also his way of urging his father and the other men of Israel out of fear and into lethargy, and into action. He probably couldn't have created serious action with 100 sermons or pep talks, but with an act of daring faith and an example of faith and courage, he forced his father and all Israel into action. He was a man of conviction. And so let's stop and consider. One man of faith, or one sister of faith. Even today, in Grand Valley Mennonite Church, in 2026, can make a difference for a whole generation or more. Do you believe that? That is the power of influence. It's the difference between just getting by in life versus living with passion and purpose, according to a conviction from God. And every one of us has been given the opportunity to be that individual, have we not? Number three, he was willing to risk his life for what he believed in. And he did this repeatedly throughout his life. He did what he knew he should do, even when he knew it might just cost him his life. And to him, it just seems like that dying for a good cause was much more worthwhile than living as a coward. And so how often do I cringe and draw back from doing what I know I should do, not because of fear of death, but just because I'm afraid somebody's going to think I'm just a little bit weird or a little bit too radical about my faith. And so, brothers, this morning, the question is not whether there is a cause. The question is not whether the cause is great enough or not. The question instead is whether you and I personally believe enough in the cause to risk everything even our own lives if necessary for the sake of the cause. That is the only real question you and I face. The other questions have already been answered with finality. And as I alluded to before, each one has been placed in the circumstances that we are in for the purpose of making a difference for the better. And God stands at the ready to honor our choices and commitment. Though it might take some time for it to work out, as we shall see in the life of Jonathan. And the next point I'd like to notice here in this story was Jonathan's relationship with his father. I think I'd already alluded to it. This mutual trust and respect between father and son. It's apparent to me even here in this first part of the story. And I mention it here again so that you can follow it all the way through. It becomes more obvious as we go on through the story. But unfortunately, I'm afraid we must say that it has little to do with the father's goodness. Rather, it was largely because the wise ways in which Jonathan conducted himself and honored his father's place in his life and in the kingdom, in spite of all his father's evil and carnality. But just notice again what takes place here in this first account. Jonathan takes a bit of risk with his father by attacking this garrison, apparently without his father's knowledge and command. But apparently he sensed enough of his father's trust and confidence to know that his father would likely rally and support him. And he did. Saul did rally and support him. In spite of Jonathan really making things worse for a while, his father did not rebuke him or shame him or take away his place of command. He respected his courage. He blew the trumpet and rallied the troops, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And likely, he was a little proud of his young son. And it seems like Saul received or even took the credit for the attack. But the victory was not won immediately. Things needed to get worse before they got better. Israel gathered, but so did the Philistines, with many chariots and horsemen and people as the sand which was on the sea in multitude. And then moving on here in chapter 13 comes the part where this army had gathered and Saul was trying to prepare to meet this army. And he was waiting for Samuel to come and offer a sacrifice before the battle. The Philistines are gathering. The Israelites are scattering, hiding in holes. Unfortunately, they didn't yet have the courage of Jonathan. Saul, in his faithlessness and fearfulness, disobeys Samuel and the commandment of the Lord. He does not honor God's delegated authority. He offers the sacrifice himself. Look at verse 13 and 14 of chapter 13. "And Samuel said to Saul, 'Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee, for now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee.'" The focus is on Jonathan this morning, not Saul so much. Can you imagine what a blow this was to Jonathan? What a discouragement, what a backset after he tried to valiantly make a difference. Let's keep reading here. Verse 15. "And Samuel rose and gat him up from Gilgal unto Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people that were present with him about 600 men. And Saul and Jonathan his son and the people that were present with them abode in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Skip to verse 19. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. Verse 22. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and with Jonathan his son there was found. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage of Michmash. Jonathan had taken a great risk, and so far, this was the current outcome. God has forsaken his father. The kingdom will never be given to Jonathan, and we don't know for sure if Jonathan knew that yet at this point, but I would say because of the closeness of father and son that he likely knew it already at this time. And he certainly later reveals it by his actions. But the Philistines are as strong as ever, and Jonathan and Saul's army is now down to 600 men. And all Jonathan has left is one armor bearer. And he could have been very discouraged, and we could say legitimately so, asking, what is the use of going on? God, why are you forsaking me? Why did you not honor my faith? But whatever discouragement he could have had, he did not linger there, because his vision was larger. His God was bigger than the present discouraging circumstances. Let's read on into chapter 14. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan the son of Saul said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison, that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Very similar to the first escapade. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. What a place for the king to be. In the uttermost part of Gibeah, it sounds like as far as he could get from danger, sitting under a tree. And the people that were with him were about 600 men. Skip down to verse 6. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And his armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Notice his contagious spirit. And I'd also like us to consider, if we can't be a Jonathan, can we at least be his armor bearer? Verse 8, then said Jonathan, behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and will not go up unto them. But if they say thus, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they had hid themselves. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will show you a thing, or we will teach you a lesson. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, come up after me. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men, within, as it were, in half an acre of land, which a yoke of oxen might plow. And there was a trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people, the garrison, the spoilers, they also trembled. And the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went on beating down one another. Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, Number now, and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said unto Ahiah, Bring hither the ark of God, for the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. And it came to pass, while Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, Withdraw thine hand. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great discomfiture. And now imagine suddenly there were swords for many of the children of Israel. Moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, which went up with them into the camp and from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines had fled, even they also followed hard after them into the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Beth-Aven. Look at all the miraculous things that took place because one man of faith did what he knew he should do, even though it was against all odds. And this account made me recall this humorous quip that some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and some people wonder what happened. And that's what it seems like took place here with Saul and his men. But yes, when we do our part, God may well engage the miraculous. Even though God was no longer with Saul, even though the kingdom would be rent from him, even though the priests of the Lord must stand helplessly by this faithless and gutless leader, God had not changed. His purposes stood firm, and he was willing and ready to bless faith wherever he found it. And lesson number 5, Jonathan knew that the kingdom was the Lord's after all, and not a man's. He not only knew it, but he lived it. And as you consider all the events of the rest of his life, he proved that he believed that with all his heart. And so take this as another major lesson from his life. Live as though the kingdom is not your own. Live as though it does not belong to any man, but rather it is the Lord's. And there is just something about the way Jonathan navigated this exceedingly difficult path amongst the surrounding evil and good, between right and wrong, in circumstances that seemed far from ideal, that I find his story unique among the heroes of faith. Yes, others stood alone. Joseph and Daniel stood alone, but it could have almost seemed like for them standing alone was easier. The lines were clear-cut. They were in a foreign country, and they simply stood alone on the beliefs that they possessed. Here, Jonathan stood alone in one sense, but on the other hand, he needed to stand alongside his father and with the current faltering kingdom. It certainly could have seemed more complicated. And yet, for us here today, this is what we typically face, is it not? In our day, in our time. Parents fail. Leaders fail. The church at times stumbles and falters. But godly men and women look to the principles of God's word, and in them discover a path for their feet, a path of respect, of honor, of well-doing in the midst of the most unideal circumstances. And as we look at his life, we must conclude that there is never a difficulty in which there are no right and honorable steps to take and move forward. Jonathan was able to navigate this treacherous terrain because he had a single eye. His highest loyalty was to God. Moving on, the Israelites pursued the battle. Verses 24 to 46 here in chapter 14 gives the account of how Saul foolishly placed the Israelites under his carnal oath not to eat anything until he was avenged of his enemies. Notice his self, his small, narrow self-focus. And we don't have the time to cover all the details here, but I'd just like to point out again this strong, yet at times challenged relationship between Saul and Jonathan. Jonathan, in ignorance, broke the command, and it was discovered that he did. Notice how he relates to his father with meekness and respect, even in this moment of judgment. And it seems to me that he is calm in facing death, knowing that he is innocent and knowing that he has given his life for a worthy cause. Verse 43 and 4 says, "Then Saul said to Jonathan, 'Tell me what thou hast done.' And Jonathan told him and said, 'I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in mine hand, and lo, I must die.' And Saul answered, 'God do so and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan.'" You see, to protect his pride and self-image, he must carry out his oath. But the people rescued Jonathan from death, and they also spared Saul from needing to slay his son. And I really do believe that Saul was pleased to be spared of that oath, because he makes no further argument, he makes no further attempt, and the issue is dropped. And so the people spared both Saul and Jonathan that day because of Jonathan's honor and respect that Jonathan commanded. But I'd like to finish here in chapter 14, verses 46 to 48, to see what the further outcome is of Jonathan's second heroic effort. It says in verse 46, "Then Saul went up from following the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place." So Saul took the kingdom over Israel. Credit to who? "And fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, and against the children of Ammon, and against Edom, and against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them. And he gathered an host, and smote the Amalekites, and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them." Leave off reading there. As vile and as undeserving as Saul was, he enjoyed a time of success. He took the kingdom over Israel on the account of his son Jonathan, who could never be the king because of Saul's evil. And it seems that it was largely because of this massive boost, because of Jonathan's faith and courage that it gave to the people, and how God honored that faith. Moving on to the next scene in Jonathan's life is in 1 Samuel chapter 18. Turn over to chapter 18. This takes place right after David slew Goliath and wrought another great victory of faith for Israel. And in these following words, we again see into the very depths of Jonathan's heart and the purity of his heart. Chapter 18, begin reading at verse 1. "And it came to pass when David had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day, and would let him go no more home to his father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, and gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. With this tremendous victory of David over Goliath, Jonathan saw not a rival, but someone of a kindred spirit with himself. He saw someone who had did very similar to what he and his armor bearer had done in facing the Philistines. David had braved Goliath alone, and he saw David here as a true spiritual brother. Seeing another young man with so great a faith in God and such a conviction for God's cause must have been a tremendous breath of fresh air for a godly man like Jonathan. And the way he responded, as I said, does nothing less than reveal the purity of his heart after God and his cause. There is no fear here. There is no jealousy. There is no rivalry. Only pure joy and delight and friendship that he has found a like-minded brother, a soulmate. And further, I believe Jonathan, having obviously been aware of the judgment of God upon his father's kingship, immediately recognizes this as the man after God's own heart and the heir to the throne. And it seems as if he, the original heir to the throne, was just looking and waiting for the right man to take his place. And he gave David his royal robe, his garments, and even his weapons in his belt. Jonathan, courageous, faithful Jonathan. High place number 6, Jonathan shows us how to relate to the injustices of life. It's very possible that in private, he needed to shed a few tears about the injustice of it all. Through no fault of his own, and though no one could have been more deserving than himself, he must surrender the kingdom to another. But to say that one could not have handled the unfairness and injustices of life more nobly seems like an understatement. And what a perfect picture of brotherhood and of how God wants all of us to relate as brothers and sisters in the family of God. A focus entirely on God and his kingdom rather than selfish pride, position, in vain glory. But the story goes on, and we know how that Saul, on the other hand, also realized the tremendous potential in David and also recognized him as the likely successor to the throne. But what a different spirit he had than Jonathan. Turn to chapter 19. Chapter 19, verse 1. And Saul spake to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. And reading on, you will continue to see that relationship that Jonathan managed to have with both Saul and David, in spite of Saul's twistedness. 19, verse 2. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeketh to kill thee. Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself unto the morning, and abide in a secret place, and hide thyself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art. And I will commune with my father of thee, and what I see, that I will tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee, and because his works have been to thee were very good, for he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine, and the Lord wrought a great salvation for all Israel. Thou sawest it and didst rejoice. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood to slay David without a cause? And notice what Saul did. Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan, and Saul sware, As the Lord liveth, he shall not be slain. And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all those things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. again. It was because of his faithfulness and loyalty to God that Jonathan was able to work this kind of respect and honor in the kingdom. I don't know that anyone has ever done such a thing like this as well as Jonathan did. And again, let's never believe that we find ourselves in places where it is just too difficult to do the right thing. If Jonathan could do this through the promptings of his conscience, through his understanding of God's will, even in the Old Testament, surely we as born-again New Testament Christians with the Spirit of God in our lives can do the same if we have a ready and a surrendered mind. We're running out of time, but moving on here, and because of Saul's evil spirit, this peace would not last. Jonathan, in his closeness and respect for his father, did not recognize it, but Saul once again had started seeking David's life, and at first Jonathan even refused to believe it, because he thought he knew his dad better than that. In chapter 20, David flees from the presence of Saul, and said, he told Jonathan, "What is mine iniquity? What have I done? What is my sin that your father seeks my life?" And Jonathan refused to believe it. But David told him that there is only a step between me and death. And so, chapter 20, verse 4, "Then Jonathan said unto David, Whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will do it, I will even do it for thee." And so here in chapter 20, verses 13 to 17, David and Jonathan make a binding covenant with each other because of the uncertainties that they faced. And Jonathan swore that he would protect David from his father's evil intent, but he also made a reasonable and responsible request on behalf of his own family. He was ready and willing to surrender the kingdom, but because of his own innocence, he wanted the assurance that his own family would be safe in the change of kingship. Because you know how it was quite common in those days, a change of succession for the incoming king to seek to destroy any potential opponents. And they also came up with a plan that would help both of them to know where Saul was in the matter, and we don't have the time to read that. But it was soon known with certainty that Saul was determined to kill David, and how it must have grieved Jonathan's pure soul with grief. The time had come that David must flee Saul's insanity, while Jonathan must remain with his father in the kingdom of Israel. And again, they renewed their oath of friendship with great cryings and tears. One can hardly imagine how Jonathan carried out his daily royal responsibilities for the next number of years. And I don't know how long that was. Maybe one of you know how long that was that David had to flee from Saul. But somehow he continued to show loyalty to the kingdom and honor his father as a faithful servant, though he never lent any true assistance in tracking down and destroying David. And somehow, because of the way that Jonathan conducted himself toward his father with honor, Saul honored him in return, or Jonathan would have had to flee along with David. Do you ever think of that? Apparently, Saul's respect was so great for Jonathan that he left him alone. And so we should never underestimate the power of showing our parents or other authority honor, no matter how dishonorable they might seem. God will protect us and reward us many times over as we do that. And the next mention of Jonathan is in chapter 23, verse 16. David again put his own life at risk to save Keilah from the Philistines, and the only reward he received from it was Saul taking the opportunity to pursue him again. But somehow Jonathan knew how to find David. And chapter 23, verse 15, "And David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. And he said unto him," and he was trying to help David stay on track here, not to fear. This is reality. "Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee. And thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. And that also Saul my father knoweth. And they two made a covenant before the Lord. And David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house." Jonathan must have lived with a constant longing and care for David. He must have frequently wept for David. And here he put his own life on the line, perhaps, for David's encouragement. And Jonathan lived in hope in spite of the circumstances. And he projected hope of when he and David could be together again, when together they could do wonderful things for God's kingdom that they longed to do without the reproach of Saul upon the land. And Jonathan was willing to be second. He faithfully served under his father Saul, and he cheerfully looked forward to serving as second in command under his friend David. But this was to be the last meeting between David and Jonathan in this life. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 31. It's the next mention of Jonathan. Verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons." As Jonathan had always done before, in spite of the circumstances, he threw himself into the cause with a will and a conviction. If something was worth fighting for, it was worth giving his life for. And I'm just going to let us use our imaginations here for a little about what may have taken place. In warfare in those days, death often did not come instantly. There were arrows and spears and swords, not bombs and bullets. Men often died as their blood ran out. So there on the battlefield with his fathers and brothers, the enemies closed in upon them. Jonathan fighting as valiantly and as faithfully as ever. But at some point, he began to realize that the dreams of his future would never come true. His lifeblood was flowing from his body. He would not be there to be the kind of father to Mephibosheth that he had always longed for himself but never had. He would never reign as second in command with his best friend. He would die with his father at the hands of his lifelong foe, the Philistines, instead. He had faced death head on many times before for a cause bigger than himself, but he had always been spared. This time, he would die. But it would be for a good cause. He knew that David would still take the kingdom and prosper in place of his father. He knew that was certain. He knew that David would care for his son, Mephibosheth, because they had made a covenant. And he knew that David would avenge the Philistines of his death. And David did destroy the Philistines many times. And he knew that God's kingdom would go on. But he had done everything he could possibly have done. He had lived in good conscience. And I choose to believe that he died as a prince with peace in his heart, because he gave his life for what he believed in. And I'd like to read 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 17 to 27 yet. Second Samuel 1, verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. And I believe it was because it was in honor of Jonathan's excellence with a bow. And he said, the beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? Jonathan was slain in his high places, in doing all the things in which he had always excelled. Just a few thoughts in summary of the high places of Jonathan's life. From him we learned the power and influence of one life lived with conviction. That we should believe in something that we are willing and ready to lay down our lives for. That each of us was placed in our present circumstances to make a positive difference with our lives. That no circumstance is too difficult or restricted to respond in right ways. That we can honor failing authority and prosper in spite of it. His life removes from us all excuses for living with a victim mentality. He showed us how to respond to the unfairness and injustices of life. And finally, he showed us how to die in grace, even when our second place dreams go unfulfilled. All glory and praise to the God of Jonathan, the God who gave Jonathan the grace to live that way. May we be challenged with the truth of God's word here again this morning. Let's kneel for a prayer.